Again, my name is Dave, for those of you that don't know, and I am the pastor here at Christ the King. And it is, it seems like, for me at least, it's been a long time coming. So it's both a sigh of relief and also just excited expectation on my part that we are beginning a new series this morning in the book of Exodus. If you're joining us for the first time, this is a great Sunday to be here as we begin this new sermon series. So let me invite you to stand if you're able, and I'm just going to start by this short reading, not the full text that we're going to be looking for at this morning, but just to kind of get us started. Please hear the word of the Lord from Exodus chapter 1, verses 1 to 14. These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. All the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation. But the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with heavy burdens. They built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses, abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel, so that they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves, and they made their lives bitter with harsh or hard service in mortar and brick and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. Well, whether it's ancient, you know, kind of epic tales, classic stories like Robin Hood, or it's, you know, the Three Musketeers, or historical stories like Saving Private Ryan, Harriet Tubman, you know, whatever it is, that we all, whether it's fiction or whether it's historical reality, we love stories of adventure in which those that are in danger and captivity, or those who are experiencing abuse of all sorts of kinds, we love it when we hear stories of rescue, of salvation, right? Well, that's the story of Exodus, which I think most of us are probably familiar with. Most of us know the story of Israel in slavery in Egypt, and the story of Moses and the parting of the Red Sea, and the plagues and everything that goes into God rescuing the people of Israel out of hundreds of years of slavery and of oppression and of abuse. And so that's the story that we're entering into this morning. And I want to just kind of set the tone for the whole of the story, the narrative, if you will. I think you've got in your bulletin kind of the three main headings. We've got the redemption from slavery itself, which I think, like I said, that's what we love. Those are the kind of stories we like. That's probably what most of us think of when we think of the story of Exodus. But it's a story of more than just rescue. It's more than just rescue from slavery. It's a story of being brought out of slavery to God in order to worship him. And so we see those three main headings. Redemption from slavery is the first 18 chapters. And then you've got covenant renewal right in the very heart of the narrative, in the very middle, almost exactly. In other words, it's as if Moses, who I think wrote this, intended for that to be the central focus. Remember, they're brought out of slavery in Egypt to the mountain at Sinai, where they would worship or serve the Lord their God. And that's where the covenant is renewed with the people of Israel. And then in the third, or the final third of the book, you've got the divine presence. The whole purpose of it is that the people of Israel might dwell with, and that the God that they worship might dwell among them. And so we've got redemption from slavery. So that kind of takes us through the oppression, the Egyptian oppression. We see Moses' call and commissioning. And in both of those, you've got, I don't know if you noticed it in the reading, but like the people of Israel are building for Pharaoh. They're building cities for him. And then at the very end of the story, the people of Israel who were once enslaved and oppressed, building cities for Pharaoh, are now liberated and free. And in their rest in the Lord, they're building for him his dwelling place. So there's those things going on. In Moses' call, we see the name of the Lord revealed. And we see the name of the Lord being the whole purpose of the Exodus, is that the people of Israel and the people of Egypt would know the Lord and know his name and know his might and his power. And then there's the Passover, and there's the Exodus, and then there's the difficulty in the wilderness as the people travel to Sinai, and then they come to the foot of the mountain where they're just overwhelmed with the presence of God, even fearful and trembling and wanting Moses to speak to them lest they just are undone by the voice of the Lord. And yet it's there at the foot of Mount Sinai, at this very central episode or scene within the book, that Israel is reminded of the fact that to know God and to be known by him, to be in communion with him, or to be in covenant relationship with him, is driven by the grace and mercy and love of God, who draws them to himself, gives them this new identity, and then tells them what it means to be his missionary people, who are to spread the message of his goodness, of his loving kindness, of his holiness, and of his justice to the nations. And of course, we're going to unpack all of that in more detail, but that's right at the center when you have the covenant preamble in chapter 19, and the commandments and laws in 20 to 23, and then the covenant confirmation in 24. And then again, after that, as if that's not enough, as if that kind of mountaintop experience, if you will, isn't a climactic enough ending, then the people of Israel get these very detailed, to us maybe overly detailed at times, instructions about how to build the tabernacle, how to build the tent in which the Lord would dwell among the people. And yet, after getting all of those detailed instructions, we see the failures of humanity, of Israel, as they worship the golden calf, and Moses has to intercede on behalf of the people and remind the Lord of his promises, of his grace, of his mercy. And that's where, again, the name of the Lord becomes central, as he proclaims the name of the Lord and reminds, well, doesn't remind, he tells Moses for the first time that the Lord and the name of the Lord, Yahweh, actually reveals his character in the revelation of his glory, when he says that he is a God compassionate and gracious, full of steadfast love and mercy, who forgives sins for generation upon generation upon generation to thousands of generations, and yet by no means clears the guilty. And again, we'll unpack more of that. But isn't it beautiful that in this story, that even despite, even in response to and in the face of human failure and rebellion against him, even as Israel itself has abused the grace of God in some respects, God remains faithful. The Lord remains faithful to his promises. And after that episode, the Israelites are told to pack up and to leave Sinai and to begin the process of going to the promised land. But before that happens, we get now very detailed, almost verbatim fulfillment of those instructions for building the tabernacle. And then the story ends somewhat on a cliffhanger, actually. Thinking about stories and adventures, it kind of ends on a cliffhanger where you can't wait to turn the next page. It's kind of like reading J.K. Rowling. If you've read Harry Potter, if you were like me, every single chapter, it didn't matter what time of day or night it was, you got to the last page of a chapter and all you wanted to do was start the next chapter because you wanted to know what happens next. And that's exactly how Exodus ends. They've built this tabernacle. The glory of the Lord comes and fills the tent of meeting. And Moses can't even go in and enter it now because the glory of God fills it. And then we're left with that question. How is a holy and just God going to dwell among and in the midst of and in relationship with an unholy people? Well, you turn the page and Leviticus is there. And that's the book we all get super excited about, right? We just want to sit and read it together out loud. But again, the details in Leviticus are all about sacrifice and atonement and the means by which God cleanses his people in order that he might live among them and that he might live, or that they might live with him in their midst. And so we, in that sense, we're picking up in the middle of a story, as we're going to see, and it's going to continue after this narrative. But even in just looking at everything we've talked about, this story of redemption from slavery to union and communion and presence, it's the story of Jesus, right? It's the prequel to Jesus. It's something that points to the one who would come and tabernacle among us, as John puts it in John 1. The one who would come and relive the life of Israel, even as we read in Matthew 2, being brought out of Egypt, and the one who would ultimately present himself and prove to be the Passover lamb, the one who was slain on our behalf, the one who came to become sin for us in order that we might be reconciled to God through his offering of himself as a sacrifice. You see, this is our story. Paul makes that clear in 1 Corinthians 10, that these stories were written for our benefit. This is an opportunity for us, as we did in Genesis, to go through the family photo album, to look through the pictures of those who have gone before us and to learn from them the lessons that they experienced. And so in that, we're going to be able to kind of focus in the different narratives and the different sub-narratives that we look at. We're going to be able to kind of engage the major themes of covenant, of promise, of the divine name and the divine presence. We're going to begin to wrestle with the beauty of what it means to acknowledge Yahweh as God, to worship him, and to experience the benefits and the blessings of those who mediate the covenant for us in order that we might then mediate the covenant of the kingdom to the world around us as a royal priesthood. There's going to be emphasis on the Passover and sacrifice and priesthood and law. There's going to be times where we think it's a little bit gory as blood is sprinkled here and there and on people. But we're also going to see the beauty of Eden being restored in the tabernacle. And we're going to get to rest in the beautiful and wondrous character of Yahweh, of the Lord who made himself known to Moses and to Israel, to David and the prophets, and who ultimately came to dwell among us in the person of Jesus. For the sake of time, I'm not going to read verbatim all of the key verses, but if you really want to hang your hat on a number of key passages, Exodus chapter 3, verses 13 to 15 would be some key verses regarding the name of the Lord. In 19:3 through 6 is where we see the Lord declaring the new identity of his people that he has brought to himself. And Exodus 34:5 through 9, we see not only the name and character of the Lord presented to Moses as he reveals his glory, but we see Moses immediately recognizing the beauty of God's grace and clinging to it and appealing to it on behalf of the people. And we're going to get to dig into all of that stuff in the weeks and months to come. And so, with all of that said, our text this morning, which is really Exodus 1:1 through 2:10, and we're going to look at those verses we didn't read as well. What it does is it sets the stage, the text we're going to look at this morning, sets the stage for the unfolding story as it kind of catches us up where or picks us up where we left off in Genesis, and it prepares us then for the ensuing battle that's going to take place between, in a sense, the forces of evil and the Lord, between Pharaoh and his armies, and between and the Lord of hosts who has come to rescue his people. And so with that, let's just kind of look first at kind of setting the stage. Verses, or chapter 1, verses 1 to 22. If you look at verses 1 to 7, we see here that this is a continuing story. This is a continuation of that which has already been going. In fact, it's true of Exodus and Leviticus, and I failed to see if it was true of Numbers, but I believe it is, all the way up until Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy, if you will, kind of recaps everything that happens in Genesis through Numbers, but in Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, the very first letter of the Hebrew is an indication that the story is continuing. If you go and you read Genesis 1, and you see how there's that repetition of "and God said," "and God said," "and God said," that "and" is actually a particular letter. It's a vayikhtol in the Hebrew, and it's this indication of continuation. And that's exactly what's happening here. We have, "and these are the names of the sons of Israel," and it's continuing the story that just ended in Genesis chapter 50. So Exodus begins with that linguistic indication of the story of Genesis continuing, but it's also, these opening verses are nearly a verbatim quotation of Genesis 46:8, which kind of serves to connect everything that's happening with what's been going on, with that which preceded it. And if that's not enough, where Genesis ended with the death of Joseph, this short list of Jacob's or Israel's sons informs us now, not only, again, of the death of Joseph, which Moses told us at the end of chapter 50 in Genesis, but this short list now includes Joseph's death and the death of his brothers along with that whole generation, which is an indication that, you know, things are changing. Things are about to progress. Now, with that line of, you know, that reminds us of the story in Genesis 1 and the Edenic calling that the people of God would be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, and the idea that the people of Israel were to be number the sands of the sea or the stars of the heavens. You almost get the sense that, like, what's about to happen is going to be positive, because the people are fruitful and multiplying and they're growing very strong. But as we're going to see, that's not exactly what happens. But God, or Moses, is actually, I think, trying to indicate to us, one, God's purposes are continuing. God's intentions for and through Israel are ongoing. And it's all connected to what he had planned for humanity in the beginning, even if we are reminded very quickly that we now inhabit, as Israel did, the world east of Eden, that we live in the midst of sorrow and brokenness. And now I've got to get back on my notes, so you'll excuse me here. So if you note in verse 7, there is this kind of reference back to the fruitfulness and the multiplication of the people and that mandate that was given to Adam and Eve that was reconstituted with Noah. And it took on more form in the call of Abraham. If you look at chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, when he was told that he was going to become this great nation that was going to be a blessing, and those who blessed them would be blessed, and those who cursed them would be cursed, which we're going to see some of the fruition of that unfolding in the story. But the point is that each successive generation that happens, God remains faithful. He remains faithful to his promises. He remains faithful to his purposes. And as we're going to see, he remains faithful to his covenants. Even though God's not mentioned at all early on, and only with reference to the faith of others in a moment, the reader is to take note of the fact that Israel, even in the midst of brokenness, even in the midst of oppression that's going to happen, is experiencing the blessings that God had promised. And so the 70 that joined Joseph in Egypt have now increased considerably, and they've become very strong. And yet, as we see in verse 8, things aren't going to unfold maybe quite like we would have expected. Verse 8 tells us that there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And that is to say that this new Egyptian king, and this was something kind of new to me because I hadn't done too much detailed work on some of these verses, but it's really probably a new dynasty that is being referenced here. There's a lot of telescoping here where the pharaohs that are mentioned throughout the story are probably multiple pharaohs, one after the other, part of a new family or a new dynasty that came into power. As commentator Doug Stewart and Christopher J.H. Wright both pointed out in their own ways, the transition that takes place here is one from the Hyksos dynasty, which was actually a Semitic group that was related to Israel, that had come from the hill country and had actually attacked and taken over Egypt and had ruled for a long time. So it's not insignificant that that Egypt had been ruled and reigned over by this foreign dynasty for a long time, and yet now this indigenous dynasty has overthrown them and taken over. And we're told, as is often the case when there's governmental shifts and changes, that this new sheriff that was in town, as it were, really wasn't concerned with Joseph, with Joseph's people, or with any of the alliances that the previous dynasty had made with the people of Israel. In fact, that idea that in verse 8 that he didn't know Joseph, that's really a soft translation of he really didn't give concern for or to Joseph. He didn't care at all about Joseph and Joseph's people. And so we see that the times were changing, and the experience of Israel in Egypt was about to look differently or different than it had, as this clear disdain for Joseph and for the people of Israel in particular, and perhaps even for other foreigners among them, was going to lead to these particular expressions of the kind of tyrannical impulse that is often embodied in nation states that seeks to systematically oppress the other, those that they're threatened by. And we see that in chapter 1, verses 9 to 22. And this is kind of throughout Scripture. I mean, there are exceptions to this to varying degrees, but it's often presented in Scripture as the tyrannical impulse being kind of the quintessential temptation of the state, if you will. That's why Babylon, kind of the great enemy of God's people in the Old Testament, is kind of often treated as the biblical archetype of institutionalized oppression, but particularly kind of institutionalized rebellion against the Lord and his anointed and the ways in which they then oppress the people of God. And we see that throughout the books of the prophets, and John particularly picks up on that in his Revelation, where Rome itself is depicted as the great Babylon, this kind of institutionalized expression of evil and resistance against the Lord and his purposes. And so in this case, it's the new Pharaoh and this new dynasty in Egypt, they're the guilty parties in that regard. And notice how Pharaoh addressed the threat. See how he kind of is threatened by and is stoking fears among the people of this sojourning alien foreign group in their midst. And we're told that he was shrewd, or he encouraged the people to be shrewd in their dealings with Israel, which, interestingly enough, it's not exactly the same word that's used to describe the serpent in Genesis 3:1, but almost every commentator comments on the kind of similarities here, that the serpent, who was craftier than any other beast, you know, here we have Pharaoh acting in a very serpent-like way in his shrewdness and in his desire to use or misuse wisdom, if you will, to manipulate. And so he manipulates the people, verse 10, and that is what then leads to this series of violent and oppressive policies that targeted the people of Israel, this sojourning alien foreign group in their midst. And oh, by the way, the treatment that the people of Israel receive, even within Exodus, not to mention throughout the rest of the Pentateuch and throughout the rest of the Old Testament, the mistreatment that Israel receives as a foreigner in a foreign land is appealed to on as why they should not mistreat those that are foreigners in their own land. Chapter 20, verse 10, 22, 21, and 23, 9. Their experience becomes the anti-paradigm for how they are to treat those who come into their land and how they are to welcome the foreigner and the alien and the stranger. Just food for thought. And this was supposed to shape this ancient expression of the church in terms of how they sought justice and sought to express mercy rather than enslaving and oppressing and tyrannizing. Now, was Israel successful? No. But it is worth noting how they were called to live and express themselves differently. But that's just an aside. We'll get to more of that as the narrative goes on. But we see that there were these policies here, right? There's enslavement right out of the gate. Chapter 1, verses 11 to 14, we see Moses emphasizing the affliction and the heavy burdens and repeats twice the ruthless slavery that Pharaoh and his taskmasters and ultimately the Egyptian people placed upon the people of Israel. And yet, don't miss this. Especially as we experience hardship and brokenness and perhaps injustice and abuse and whatever, in the various ways that we might experience that, even in the midst of their suffering, we're told that they still continue to experience God's blessing and the blessings that came from their good God. In verse 12 and 20, we're told they continued to grow and multiply and they continued to gain strength. God continues to be faithful to his promises and to his people, even in the midst of the oppression that they're experiencing. But if slavery wasn't enough, which that was hard and harsh as it was, seeing that they were continuing to grow and multiply, and Pharaoh seeing that his first approach was failing, now attempts genocide through infanticide. And you note that Jesus being born into the rule and reign of Herod, he as one who was born king of the Jews, as the wise men declared, was a threat to the powers that be. And what was Herod's response but infanticide? And it's just Jesus playing out the life of Israel, as it were. But here in Exodus, we see that the first kind of genocidal, infanticidal policy is in verses 15 to 21, where the midwives are told that if a child is born to an Israelite woman, if it's a daughter, she can live. If it's a son, they were to kill the son. Well, that, as we're going to see, didn't pan out quite as Pharaoh had expected. And so policy number two is to just simply take any male child of Israel and cast him into the river Nile to be drowned. And so we see just Pharaoh raging against the Lord and against his anointed as he rages against the people of Israel and ultimately is threatening, as we're going to see, that promise that was given to Eve, that the seed of the woman that took on more detail in the call of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob would crush the head of the serpent. And so we see this kind of battle that's going on between the seeds, if you will, between Pharaoh, kind of this personification of the serpent and the seed of the serpent, and between the people of God who are and will be the means by which the seed of the woman enters into the world to crush and defeat evil, sin, and death. And so, kind of moving on to that second point, Pharaoh's tyrannical impulse was a threat to that promise and therefore was an early expression, again, of what Psalm 2 talks about, the nations plotting and raging against the Lord and against his anointed. But here's something really cool, I think, that might be easily missed. In those two final policies, the Israelite sons, now some of your translations might say descendants or children, boys and girls. The emphasis really is on sons and daughters. And that's going to play itself out in the sense that just as Pharaoh targets the sons of Israel, you know, that final plague is going to target the son or the sons of the Egyptians. And so there's some significance there. But also, I think there's some significance going on in this. The Israelite sons were targeted, but the daughters were ignored. And they were used, actually, in that first plot, or in that first one, as instruments in Pharaoh's plot. Now, there's some debate and discussion about whether or not the midwives of the Egyptians or of the Hebrews were Egyptian midwives, or if they were Hebrew midwives. And there's kind of data that goes one way or the other. I think they were probably Israelites, given their names, which we'll come back to in just a second. But here's the thing. They were being used as instruments, but that was going to backfire in a number of ways, as the author emphasizes and highlights here. The daughters were ignored. They weren't seen as a threat, and yet they are going to prove to be the undoing of Pharaoh. So the women here in the story resisted the powers of evil, and they are the ones who preserved or saved, if you will, that promised seed. Note that none of the Pharaohs are mentioned by name, but the two midwives, these daughters of Israel, Shiphrah and Puah, are honored as heroes or heroines of Israel for their brave, bold, and their brilliantly expressed faith. You see in verse 17, they refused to follow Pharaoh's orders because they feared God. And they resisted Pharaoh. Their resistance of him is what leads to the rest of the unfolding story coming as it does. And it's funny, their rationale must have been somewhat plausible. It had to have been plausible enough that they could get away with what they said. Some commentators debate whether or not they outright lied or whether or not they simply utilized something that was kind of a known reality for their own purposes. In other words, everybody kind of knows that the Israelite women give birth quickly, and sometimes it's hard to get there in time, and so we're just going to kind of take our time. We're going to mosey on over to the tent where this child is being born, and oh no, we didn't get there in time. These women, they give birth so quickly. So they tell Pharaoh that. He buys it, so it seems to have been plausible enough. And so there's the first, you know, now he's had two attempts to repress and oppress the people. And he's had two attempts to stop the growth of Israel through the killing of the sons of Israel. And here now, again, is failure. And this time it's failure because of the boldness and the bravery and the heroism of these two women who preserved life and protected the sons of Israel. But it wasn't just those two either, right? It actually gains momentum and gains more emphasis. Because now we see in chapter 2, verses 1 to 10, which I'm not going to read, but please just kind of note the verses that I reference here. Moses' mother, it doesn't tell us explicitly or linguistically in this sense, but the implication is she acts shrewdly in her own way, and in a God-fearing act of faith, she technically complies with this new policy, and she eventually casts Moses into the Nile, chapter 2, verses 1 to 3, but she doesn't just cast him into the Nile kind of without any help, right? What does she do? She builds him a little ark. That's actually what it is, and there's the bitumen and pitch, just like the ark of Noah, so another nod back to Genesis. She puts Moses, who's going to eventually be the mediator and representative of Israel to God and God to Israel, she puts him in this little ark and she casts him into the Nile. She does what she was told. kind of cunning and crafty, wise as a serpent, innocent as a dove in a sense. But here's the real part where we see Pharaoh's failure in an embarrassing and ironic sort of way, because who is it that finds Moses in the Nile and rescues him but Pharaoh's own daughter? He thought so little of the daughters, it doesn't matter if they live, but let's kill the sons. But it's the daughters of Israel, and now it's the daughter of his own house. And if you think that's overemphasizing, Moses tells us 5 times that the daughter of Pharaoh is the one who took him out, who rescued him, who brought him into her home, who raised him as her own son. And so it's eventually her that is the one that rescues Moses. And then, you know, again, eventually named, but another woman who's present in all of this and participating in the battle against the seed of the serpent is Miriam, Moses' own sister. She's there. She's thinking on her feet. And she's demonstrating boldness and courage and bravery as she is the one that comes up with the idea to find a wet nurse and goes and gets Moses' mom so that Moses' mom can nurse him and raise him and know him, even though he eventually is going to be living in the house of Pharaoh, where Pharaoh himself is going to see to it that he's educated and is capable of doing the things that he eventually does. Have we ever thought about the irony there? That Pharaoh himself has the son being raised in his own house by his own daughter, being taught all the ways of the Egyptians, all of their myths, all of their wisdom and everything. And he's the one who's going to come now, speaking their own language, and is going to come and is going to be the mouthpiece of God to Pharaoh in order that he might bring the people of God out of slavery. And here at the very end of chapter 2, verse 10, you see, when the child grew older, she, that is Moses' mother, brought him to Pharaoh's daughter. Again, that final kind of reference there. And he became her son. And she named him Moses because, she said, I drew him out of the water. And what's going to happen to Pharaoh? Exactly what he had intended to happen to Moses and all the sons of Israel. He and his host are going to drown in the waters of the Red Sea. And so we already begin to see how the Lord is coming to be with his people in order to rescue them and make his name known, and is coming in order that he might defeat evil, sin, and death as the story begins to unfold and eventually is going to point us again to the hope of our salvation through the exodus of Jesus, the Passover lamb who was slain on the cross on our behalf. And just like the Israelites, as we'll see, participated in the Passover through eating the Passover, we now come to the Lord's table in order that we might participate in the sacrifice of Jesus through faith, in order that we might experience the benefits and the blessings of what he did on Calvary. Amen? Amen. Let's pray.